WVW Broadcast Network and The New American are pleased to present The New American Television. This program is dedicated to bringing you the truth behind the news.
Welcome to The New American TV, where we bring you the truth behind the news. Today's Tuesday, June 13th, and I'm your host, Paul Dragoo. Gavin Newsom is the governor of the state that Americans are leaving the most. He governs a state from which hundreds of companies have recently left, including the largest home insurance provider. California is a state that refuses to protect its citizens from wildfires. And it was one of the most tyrannical states during the scandemic, an authoritarian nightmare that almost resulted in Newsom's recall. Under Newsom, California has become a wasteland, complete with thriving homeless communities and around-the-clock theft, stabbings, and shootings. And now, Gavin Newsom wants to share his not-so-unique ability to destroy nice places and make people's lives miserable with the entire nation. He recently announced that he would like to destroy the Second Amendment. Here he is.
In this country, we do have the power to change things, to reclaim our freedom from fear. Our ability to make a more perfect union is literally written into the Constitution. So today, I'm proposing the 28th Amendment to the United States Constitution to do just that. The 28th Amendment permanently enshrines four additions to the laws of our land. It raises the minimum age to purchase a firearm from 18 to 21. Because if you can't buy a beer, you shouldn't be able to buy a gun. It mandates universal background checks to prevent truly dangerous people from purchasing a gun that can be used in a crime. It institutes reasonable waiting periods for all gun purchases, and it bans civilians from buying assault rifles, those weapons of war our founding fathers never foresaw. This will guarantee states as well the ability to enact common sense gun safety laws while leaving the Second Amendment intact and respecting America's gun-owning tradition. The 28th locks in the common sense constitutional protections that Democrats, Republicans, independents, and gun owners overwhelmingly support. And it ensures NRA-owned politicians can never strip those protections away. This fight won't be easy, and it certainly won't be fast. Convening a constitutional convention requires two-thirds of the states to call for this. California will be the first. But that's just the beginning. Join us.
What's truly interesting is not so much that someone like Newsom, a natural tyrannical stooge, wants to destroy your Second Amendment, but the method that he's proposing, a constitutional convention. This is the same method many well-meaning conservatives propose to rein in our out-of-control government. Many conservatives believe that if a modern-day constitutional convention is called, it would propose amendments to the U.S. Constitution to restrain federal spending and federal powers. This is the method that Convention of States organization, a supposedly pro-American entity, has received millions of dollars from mysterious donors to make happen. It's also the same method John Birch Society members have fought tooth and nail against in nearly every state legislature. Gavin Newsom's recent anti-Second Amendment ploy is another example of why this is the worst time in American history to hold a constitutional convention or a con-con. Newsom's proposed amendment would strengthen national gun laws and thereby gut the Second Amendment. So can Newsom's proposal actually become reality? How about any other bad amendments that a con-con might bring? In a couple of minutes, my co-host Rebecca Terrell will elaborate some more on this unique threat. And it turns out that Instagram is a great place for pedophiles looking for child pornography and meetings with children. According to a bombshell report from the Wall Street Journal, the popular social media platform, Instagram, is a haven for vast pedophile networks. Researchers from the journal, the Stanford Internet Observatory, and University of Massachusetts Amherst created test accounts to see how quickly they could prompt Instagram's suggested for you feature to recommend accounts that sell child sex content. The test accounts were immediately hit with content that sexualizes children, including links to external platforms where people can trade such material or services. The Stanford Internet Observatory discovered 405 sellers participated in what researchers refer to as self-generated child sexual material. Some of these accounts may have been operated by children themselves. Instagram also allowed users to search for terms the algorithm recognized was associated with illegal material. In some instances, a pop-up appeared on the screen, warning the results might contain images of child sexual abuse. However, despite the warning, users could still click on See Results anyway. And it gets worse. Instagram provided menus with prices for videos depicting children engaging in self-harm or sexual acts with animals. Instagram also allowed for child prostitution to be offered to interested users. Per the report, quote, at the right price, children are available for in-person meetups, end quote. To avoid getting caught, pedophiles coded their messages with the emoji system. For example, an emoji of a map means a minor attracted person. A cheese pizza emoji is abbreviated to mean CP or child porn. An example of this covert communication system was discovered in the emails of John Podesta, the campaign manager for the Clinton campaign. WikiLeaks made the emails public in 2016. This revelation gave rise to the Pizzagate theory, which alleged that then-presidential candidate Hillary Clinton was involved in a clandestine child sex slavery operation. Furthermore, the Clinton family, along with other prominent political figures, had established connections with the billionaire pedophile Jeffrey Epstein, who operated a global sex trafficking ring. Epstein died in prison in a supposed suicide in 2019 while waiting trial on federal sex trafficking charges. Meta, the parent company of Instagram and Facebook, was responsible for 85% of the child pornography reports submitted to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, according to the journal. The company admitted that they had received numerous reports regarding child sexual exploitation, but failed to act due to technical issues and were currently taking steps to fix them. Tucker Carlson, among others, condemned the ongoing normalization of pedophilia in America. He dedicated the second episode of his wildly popular Twitter show to the shattering of what he called the greatest taboo of all, child molestation.
The people who run our country no longer see child molesters as the worst among us. It's never been more obvious than it was yesterday when the Wall Street Journal ran a long expose about kiddie porn on Instagram. Instagram, the journal found, quote, helps connect and promote a vast network of accounts openly devoted to the commission and purchase of underage sex content. Instagram connects pedophiles and connects them to content sellers of child pornography. In one instance, the paper discovered that Instagram was recommending the phrase incest toddlers to users who'd expressed interest in similar material. By the way, no one at Instagram denied that any of this had happened, nor did Mark Zuckerberg, who controls the company. The journal story was accurate. It was all pretty shocking, but not as shocking as what happened next, which was effectively nothing at all. The largest circulation newspaper in the United States revealed that one of the world's most influential companies was promoting pedophilia, and nobody in power did anything about it. The Justice Department did not announce an investigation. Congress did not schedule hearings. The guy who runs Instagram, Adam Mosseri, still has his job. In fact, Mosseri's last tweet, which is pinned, is a video of himself bragging about how effective Instagram's algorithm is.
Join me to discuss today's stories is TNA senior editor Rebecca Terrell. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi, Paul. Great to see you.
So do you still have your breakfast or have you upchucked it? I mean, this is just...
Right.
This is... Well... This is
well, there just aren't words.
Right, right.
There are hardly words. But I was thinking as we were talking about that, you know, so many people, we look down our noses at previous cultures that engaged in child sacrifice and things like, oh, how could they be such monsters? What are we? If our country is, this is a huge problem. And I agree with Tucker Carlson's, you know, saying this is one of the most horrible things that's going on right now in our world and in our country. And the fact that we're talking about this in June, which has been declared
Pride Month.
And we know that statistics prove there's a lot higher incidence of child pedophilia and pederasty among homosexual populations than there is among heterosexual populations. What are we celebrating here?
Yeah, Yeah. Well, you know, what do you think about the leak? How strong do you think this link is between those Podesta emails, those leaked emails, and now we're finding out that those code words are legitimate? There's pedophilia networks out there using those code words. What is your thought? I guess it'd be purely speculative, but not so much so. But we know that. Do you really think that there was a connection between that campaign and pedophilia networks?
Well, I mean, I have no way of knowing. I don't have a crystal ball to be able to tell you definitively, but it certainly, I certainly wouldn't want to have anything like that in my email trail. It looks particularly damning.
Yeah. I mean, it wouldn't be surprising, I suppose. I mean, you look at what we found out from the Jeffrey Epstein, and surely, I mean, these were people, you know, these were elites who were getting, you know, the stuff catered to them. It wouldn't be surprising. But like you said, obviously, we don't know, but it sure is suspicious.
Right. You know, I want to go back, though, I think we're also going to go back and talk about Gavin Newsom and the Convention of States, because that is... I don't want to say it's even more important. That the issue of the child molestation and pornography and pedophilia, that is so damning because it is so directly out of hell. It truly is. It is evil. Demonic.
Yep.
It is pure evil. But if we lose our Constitution, though, we're going to lose any hope of bringing an end to things like these horrors that we're talking about. We must put this at the forefront of our action as citizens. We cannot lose our Constitution, and that is exactly what these people are going for. Mm-hmm. Mark Meckler, who runs the Convention of States, who's been pushing for this constitutional convention, and he swears up and down, no, we're not going to, it's only going to improve what we already have. Well, they're already not paying attention to what we have, so improving it, that's not a valid argument. But we also know, too, that, like, for instance, one of the people on his legal advisory board for Convention of States is a Princeton professor, Robbie George. And he has, in the past, been a part of the National Constitution Center's Constitution Drafting Project. They have already drafted a constitution that they plan to implement when they do get enough states to call for a constitutional convention. And Article 1, Section 12, Clause 7 of that newly drafted Constitution. I'm going to read it. I'm going to read an excerpt from it because it's rather long. It's legalese. Yeah. But it says, neither the states nor the United States shall make or enforce any law infringing the right to keep and bear arms of the sort ordinarily used for self-defense or recreational purposes, provided that the states in the United States may enact and enforce reasonable regulations on the bearing of arms and the keeping of arms by persons determined with due process to be dangerous to themselves or others. Now, who are some of the people who have been determined recently to be domestic terrorists who would obviously not be allowed? Those would be parents appearing at school board meetings to protest all of these gay rights, Pride Month, critical race theory, child
mutilation. Right.
Yes, child mutilation. So, you know,
anyone to the right of Joe Manchin is a domestic terrorist.
Absolutely. And you have to understand, too, that when we are talking about a new constitution being implemented, just because it shares the name Constitution with what's there right now, does not mean it's the same thing. When we get a new constitution, we will have an entirely new government.
Yeah.
And I think we were talking, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No. It's just, this is, what are the narratives we've heard from Meckler and COS and a lot of the well-intended patriots who follow it is that they'll be able to keep this under control. But clearly the left knows that's not the case. They're so good at cheating, and we've seen that it'd be insane to think that we could keep this from turning into a runaway convention.
Absolutely. And, you know, we just, our own Veronica Karolinko just got back from the UK, where she attended the conference on COVID over there. It was some great interviews that she got, and I encourage everyone to visit thenewamerican.com and see some of that. But she mentioned when we were talking privately about it that how very, very different it is over in the UK, how it's just really a socialist country. everything. Your life is ruled. You obtain permission from the government before you can do anything. And that's exactly what we're going to be looking at. I mean, don't hide your head in the sand. If we get a new constitution, that's exactly what we will be. We will be wards of the federal government. The founders wanted the states to tell the federal government not what to do, not the other way around. We can take care of ourselves. In fact, our Constitution now not only prohibits the federal government from restricting the right to keep and bear arms, it also implicitly prohibits the states from restricting the right to keep and bear arms.
Yes.
So that's how fundamental it is.
I hope people find this as another wake-up call. We've reported, the John Birch Society has fought tooth and nail, and we've reported on so many of these concerning trends. You know, when Glenn Beck withdrew his support was another one. But over and over, we're finding out that this is, you know, we've known for a while, but hopefully now well-meaning compatriots are convinced this is a terrible idea because Newsom is a tyrant. He's proved it so, and this is the kind of person who wants a constitutional convention. Thanks, Rebecca. So stay tuned, folks, because when we come back, we'll look at the latest twist in the destruction of Nord Stream 2. We'll be right back.
They say I'm part of a global plan. I don't think so. It's too hot. It's too cold. You know what? The weather changes.
Here's the news, Dad.
Nope. It's hard to tell what's real and what's fake these days.
Ditch the fake news and always get the truth. Go to thenewamerican.com.
Welcome back. So who blew up the Nord Stream pipelines? Nearly 9 months after underwater explosions ripped open three natural gas pipelines running from Russia to Germany through the Baltic Sea, we still don't know the answer. Last September, just days following the incident, International Energy Agency Executive Director Fatih Birol told a conference on renewable energy in Paris that, quote, it is very obvious who was behind this issue, end quote. Western officials and media immediately began blaming Russia. Others questioned the likelihood of that motive, considering the lucrative European Union market. It didn't make sense that Russia would cripple its own energy exports. Russia, in turn, blamed G7 countries, especially the United States, citing, among other evidence, President Joe Biden's promise in February of 2022 of what would happen to Nord Stream 2 should Russia invade Ukraine.
That means tanks or troops crossing the border of Ukraine again. Then there will be no longer a Nord Stream 2. We will bring an end to it.
How will you do that exactly, since the project and control of the project is within Germany's control?
I promise you, we'll be able to do it.
Sure enough, this past February, Seymour Hersh published his earth-shaking Substack report, How America Took Out the Nord Stream Pipeline. Here's his summary from an interview with Democracy Now!
Here's what Biden did, and this is what I think the ultimate point of the story, why so many people, even the intelligence community, are very troubled by it. What he did is he said, I'm in a big war with Ukraine. It's not looking good. I want to be sure I get German and West European support, and I know winter's coming, and if it's going to be bad, I don't want the Germans to say, we got to check out because we're getting massacred. We'll be massacred with no cheap fuel. And our economy will go bonkers. We're going to check out and we're going to open up the gas line, which they could do. So he took away that option.
That kind of talk earned the Pulitzer Prize winning investigative journalist the expected media backlash. Like this Business Insider headline, the claim by a discredited journalist that the U.S. secretly blew up the Nord Stream pipeline is proving a gift to Putin. Indeed, Russian President Vladimir Putin called for a U.N. investigation. He accused Germany, Denmark, and Sweden of cover-ups in their investigations into the bombings. However, only China and Brazil supported Russia's motion, so it failed. At the same time, the New York Times, the Washington Post, and various German media outlets began broadcasting news blaming Ukraine for the blasts. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky denied this. Putin dismissed these allegations as sheer nonsense and once again accused the U.S. of an economic motive. He told an interviewer that theoretically, the United States is interested in stopping the supply of Russian energy to the European market and supplying volumes of its own. Then, in April, authorities arrested 21-year-old Jack Teixeira on charges that he leaked classified Pentagon documents online. The Washington Post claimed to obtain a copy of the sensitive papers, which supposedly revealed the U.S. knew of a Ukrainian plot to attack Nord Stream 3 months before the underwater bombs detonated. Now, German investigators have announced a Polish link, saying that a sabotage team may have used the EU neighbor and NATO ally as a base of operations to carry out the attack. According to the Wall Street Journal, Germany believes a yacht named Andromeda holds the secret to the real perpetrators. The article says that the boat sailed around each of the locations where the blast later took place and that the yacht was rented through a travel agency with Ukrainian connections. Well, Rebecca, what do you make this of this continuing saga here?
Well, it does seem like everybody's pointing the finger of blame at everyone else, but the theory that I think is probably the most accurate would be that the G7 certainly don't want the power shift to go from the Atlantic into to Eastern Europe and the Orient. We know that the BRICS countries are already trying to form their own currency, a multinational currency among them. And, you know, if they allowed that Nord Stream pipeline to connect Russia to Germany, we know the problems that all of Europe is having with energy, the lack of energy resources and extremely high prices. And to cut that off is to cut off a major,
major source of
energy for Europe. So, and we're looking at, for instance, the head of NATO right now used to be the prime minister of Norway, and Norway's a big energy producer. So it's not just the U.S. that stands to benefit economically, as Putin has said, from Nord Stream leaks.
Yeah.
So, you know, who knows if we'll ever actually know, but there's just a lot of, it seems to me that the economic motive is very strong.
Yeah. You know? Well, what about, deep divers, the talent or the ability, I guess I'm not trying to put Ukraine down, but, I think it's like a second world country. They don't seem like someone who would have a lot of people with that training, but I'm sure they would have some. And secondly, just because someone used a Ukrainian travel agency, that doesn't mean that, you know, the U.S. or a Western country wasn't involved. You know, what do you think of that?
Well, the U.S. has not been shy about bragging about everything that we've been giving to Ukraine and supporting Ukraine. And even our congressmen are wearing Ukrainian flags on their lapels in our own House and Senate. At the federal level, that should be worrisome to people. The fact that it's not is even more worrisome. So we're just going to have to keep our fingers on the pulse of this and see how it.
Yeah. Like you say, we may never know. This seems to be shaping that way. Thank you, Rebecca, so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Paul.
And that's all for our news segment today. For more Truth Behind the News, make sure to get a subscription to The New American Magazine. You can do so online at thenewamerican.com, or you can call our office at 800-727-8783, Monday through Friday from 8 to 5 Central Time. And stay tuned, because we'll be right back with more New American TV. Steve Bonta and Selwyn Duke will be discussing the future of AI technology.
The John Birch Society has been working tirelessly since 1958 to preserve freedom, safeguard the Constitution, and restore our God-given rights. We continually educate voters and lead the freedom movement. Join us as we work against a tyrannical one-world government. United as one, we can defeat this conspiracy against a free America. JBS founder Robert Welch said, "Education is our total strategy and truth our only weapon." Join us in restoring this great nation.
Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Bonta. I'm the executive senior editor with The New American Magazine. And with me today is Selwyn Duke for one of our regular conversations. We like to talk with Selwyn periodically, particularly about issues of cultural importance. So today, we're going to be discussing a matter that's been on everyone's mind, I would say, particularly over the last few months, although it's a subject that over the last few decades has cropped up from time to time as computers and information technology have made progress. And of course, as science fiction and the popular culture has sort of encouraged people to think about it, the issue is AI, or artificial intelligence, and what the prospects are for it to affect us going forward because of the meteoric rise of ChatGPT and other AI programs in the last few months, and just has just captivated the public, not only in the United States, but across much of the developed world. And so we're confronting yet again this question of exactly what is AI? Is it dangerous? Is it something that can be embraced? Could it conceivably, you know, Terminator, Skynet style, at some point take over the United States, even lead to human extinction, or otherwise enslave us, like we see in the popular movie franchise, The Matrix? We're all familiar with the tropes involving AI. And you know, for much of the time that, you know, computers have been part of the warp and woof of culture, most of the people concerned about the alleged dangers of AI have not been people who know a lot about it. The tendency has been to say, well, you know, this stuff is science fiction, but it won't happen in real life. And now what we've been seeing in the last few months are just a cavalcade of experts in the field warning that this could be the next technological Pandora's box, at least the equivalent of splitting the atom and, the nuclear tests at Trinity and so forth that led to the nuclear arms race and, of course, those perils. So we're going to discuss today a little bit whether or not this is exaggerated. Just to frame this issue a little more, just a couple of weeks ago in Scientific American, this article appeared. I'm just going to read a couple of excerpts from it by one Tamlin Hunt, who says, a 2023 survey of AI experts found that 36% fear that AI development may result in a nuclear-level catastrophe. Almost 28,000 people have signed on to an open letter written by the Future of Life Institute, including Steve Wozniak, Elon Musk, the CEOs of several AI companies, and many other prominent technologists, asking for a six-month pause or a moratorium on new advanced AI development. And the writer goes on to say, why are we all so concerned? In short, AI development is going way too fast. The key issue is the profoundly rapid improvement in conversing among the new crop of advanced chatbots, or what are technically called large language models, LLMs. With this coming AI explosion, we will probably have just one chance to get this right. If we get it wrong, we may not live to tell the tale. This is not hyperbole, claims the author. And goes on to state, for example, well, the problem with AI is that in theory, it can become super intelligent, surpassing us in intelligence, and within another year or two, learn by itself, become in effect autonomous, no longer reliant on programmers and human masters, and in such a situation could conceivably unleash havoc on the human race, including perhaps, again, a Terminator Skynet-style nuclear holocaust. So this is kind of the framework for our discussion. And, Selwyn, we talked a little bit before this interview, and I think we're going to find our opinions on this topic diverge a little bit, which always makes for good and stimulating conversation. What is your take on AI? Do you think it realistically poses a danger from the point of view of technology becoming self-aware or something of that nature?
Yeah. Well, I have to say that I do think it's a possibility, Steve, and I'll explain why a little later, but it's very interesting because in the year 2000, 23 years ago, co-founder of Sun Microsystems, Bill Joy, wrote this article, this essay that went viral, and it's titled, Why the Future Doesn't Need Us. And basically what he was warning about was that with the advance of technology, we could reach a point where the technology would actually supplant us. And as the way he put it, I'm paraphrasing now, is that a species seldom survives an encounter with a superior species. And he was concerned that we could in the future be that, quote, inferior species that comes out on the short end of the stick. But now, actually, there are people warning about that, many of them, human extinction brought about by artificial intelligence. But here's the kicker. There are tech giants who actually welcome that in a way. Now, it's not that they're like that serial killer who most people have forgotten, Carl Panzen, who said, "I wish that all of humanity had just one neck so I could choke it." No, these people aren't necessarily misanthropes. But what it is that there are different kinds of extinctions that have been defined here. And but we before we get into that, let's get into the theory or what you could even call the religion behind this. Now, Andre Torres wrote an article about this. He's a historian and philosopher, and he called this the Tescreal Bundle. He calls these people Tescrealists. Now, what would this be? Well, it's an acronym, Tescreal, and it stands for, quote, transhumanism, extropianism, singularitarianism, cosmism, rationalism, effective altruism, and long-termism. And the issue is that there are many tech giants, Steve, who absolutely subscribe to this. Now, those are a lot of big words. So anyway, what does it amount to? Well, I'm going to quote here Torres, if I may, writing at Salon. And he said, at its heart, this belief, quote, is a techno-utopian vision of the future in which we re-engineer humanity, colonize space, plunder the cosmos, and establish a sprawling intergalactic civilization full of trillions and trillions of, quote, happy, unquote, people, nearly all of them, quote, living inside enormous computer simulations. In the process, all our problems will be solved and eternal life will become a real possibility. So you can see how it sounds like a religion. Now, whether or not you think these individuals can actually pull this off is not the point here, Steve. The point is that this is subscribed to, like I said, by a great number of tech oligarchs. And they are the ones funding the development of artificial intelligence. So look, even if they can't pull this off, they could really mess up a lot of things in the process. And that is the problem here that we have. Now, again, you can stop me if I'm going on too long, but let me tell you why I think this is a real threat. And understand that I'm coming from the point of view of a man of faith. Okay, so I'm not one of these secular techno-utopians here. Because a lot of people of faith are going to say, well, no, this is God's domain. Man could never create anything approximating life. Well, here's the thing. I view it this way, Steve. We can't create a being with a soul. We can't create the soul. But I believe, obviously, anything that occurs in the natural world is possible. And if we can observe it for long enough, we can eventually replicate it, I believe. Now, we've gained great understanding of neural networks, how the brain works, so many other things. There's nanotechnology. So could we create a synthetic being or a robot or an android that is immensely intelligent, millions of times as intelligent as a human being, and that who even has intellect and free will? Could we do that, a soulless being? I think it's possible. And even if it's not, though, like I said, these tech oligarchs could really destroy a lot in the process, you know. And the problem, I guess I'll cede the floor to you in a moment, but, you know, the problem here, Steve, and this is why we have to approach this with some humility, but we also have to understand the danger is that we're heading into uncharted territory. You know, Michael Crichton, the late novelist, put it very, very well in a speech once. He talked about what people didn't know in 1903 about the way the world would be in 2003. And he ran down a list of maybe 70 things that they had no idea about, the atom, so on and so forth. And then he said, do you really think we have any idea what the world is going to be like 100 years hence? You know, that's the problem. We don't know where technology is going to take us. And what pertains to this is something called the singularity. Now, as that relates to artificial intelligence, that's the point where the theory goes. Artificial intelligence gets to a point where it recursively improves itself, it self-improves, and at that stage, we don't know what's going to happen. We don't know what's beyond the singularity. So that's the fear that many, many people have.
Well, you know, I don't profess to be the kind of expert on this that our colleague Dennis Berendt is. He recently wrote a book about this very issue. But there are certain assumptions, spoken and unspoken. And, you know, looking at a little bit more of this Scientific American article, it does say, for example, further on, once AI systems are built into robots, I'm quoting now, they will be able to act in the real world rather than only the virtual electronic world, with the same degree of super intelligence, and will, of course, be able to replicate and improve themselves at a superhuman pace, which is, in essence, what you were talking about a minute ago. He goes on to say, any defenses or protections we attempt to build into these AI gods, in quotes, on their way toward godhood will be anticipated and neutralized with ease by the AI once it reaches superintelligence status. This is what it means to be super intelligent. We won't be able to control them because anything we think of, they will have already thought of a million times faster than us. Now, granting all of that, first of all, again, notice the use of words like gods and godhood. There is that implication, all right? However, there's the unspoken assumption here that intelligence is, and thought, he uses both of these terms here, and consciousness are all the same thing. Or that they're, well, they're different, actually. Early in the article, he says, you know, even if these machines aren't conscious, they can still, they're still a danger. And later on, he says this, I'm not sure if they'll become conscious, but he continues to use this word intelligent. And so the assumption is that intelligence and consciousness are two different things, that you can have something that is intelligent, that acts precisely like a conscious, intelligent being, that mimics what it does exactly, and yet is not, in fact, conscious, or as we would say, perhaps self-aware. I would also point out that, you know, I'm not sure that this is as unique as we like to think it is, because for a long time, we've been designing machines that can do certain defined tasks better than counterparts in the natural world. So we have machines that can fly faster than any living organism, okay? But that said, right, do we have any machine that can replicate the complex flight patterns of a hummingbird or a barn swallow or a chimney swift or a peregrine falcon or anything like that? We have machines that through brute force can go in a more or less straight line a lot faster than any organism, just like we have, you know, vehicles that can go much faster than the fastest cheetah or gazelle, but they can't move like a cheetah or gazelle. And even the most sophisticated robots that they're now designing can shoot baskets, but they can't move like Michael Jordan used to be able to. We can't do it anymore. And, you know, and so one might say, well, but sooner or later we'll get around to that. But that begs the question, are we, after all, simply meat machines? Now, many years ago when I was a graduate student in linguistics, we dealt with this problem with regard to human language. And this was in the early 90s, right before Deep Blue had been rolled out, at the time that then world chess champion Garry Kasparov was saying, they'll never be able to design a computer program that can beat me. And I remember one of my advisors at the time who had a double PhD in computational linguistics and physics said to me, that's not true. He said, within 2 or 3 years, there'll be computer programs that can beat anyone alive, including Garry Kasparov. Why? Because chess is a bounded activity. It's something that truly is computational at root. And while the human mind can also do computation, if it focuses enough, it can't do it as well as a machine. That is a very mechanistic, mechanical thing. Okay? But, he went on to assure me, we will never have machines that can use language the way humans can. And I think that's true. We are at the point now where, you know, the ChatGPTs, they can produce a simulacrum of human language use in a very bounded kind of way. And it is bounded. But we have learned a lot about language over the last 100 years that suggests that it's not just a wetware computer program, that whatever goes into this organic thing called consciousness, of which language is probably our best available, you know, template that we can kind of look at and examine to guess at what its properties might be. Some of these Native American, you know, American Indian languages like Navajo and Cherokee and so forth do things. They're called polysynthetic languages, and they do things that the old-fashioned languages that we studied in school, the European languages with the noun declensions and the verb, they just don't work that way at all. And yet, they are just as as successful at communicating ideas. And I would doubt very much that you could ever program a computer to use a polysynthetic language, just as one example. That, of course, is a bit of an article of faith on my part. But having studied language for years and years, it is a mistake, in my opinion, to confound computation with actual thought and consciousness with whatever it is going on in, with basically, you know, whatever is causing computers to work and computer programs to work. perhaps I'm naive in so doing. I'm simply saying, well, because only God can create a soul and so forth and so on. Just looking at the evidence and the way language works, the most eminent linguist of our time, Noam Chomsky, his theories about human language really don't hold up unless you regard human language as a bounded wetware computer program. And so they've worked very well in helping to develop machine-assisted translation and all that stuff. But as an actual model of what human language is, not so much. So I don't fear the future, but I'll give you the last word. We're getting close to the end of time, but that's my say on the subject.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't fear the future. That's where faith comes into play. I mean, God wins in the end. But the bottom line, though, is that as technology advances, we can replicate more and more. And you say, well, they would just be good mimics. Yeah, I think that's sort of the point. And I mentioned at the outset, and I guess I should really conclude this point or close the circle on it, that a lot of these test realists, or at least some, welcome the extinction of Homo sapiens. Now, what does that mean? Well, according to this Torres fellow who I quoted, there are three types of extinction actually that are relative here. One is terminal extinction, which is where all the humans disappear. That's your grandfather's extinction. The next one is final extinction, where that occurs and we have no successor, okay? And then you have normative extinction, where we do have a successor, but it lacks some important value that we possess. Something, he mentions, such as consciousness. Now, it's only the last two types of extinction, final and normative, that these test realists fear. And a lot of them, again, approach this as a religion, it seems. And they really actually like the idea of the extinction of Homo sapiens if that means that we're going to be replaced by something superior. They view this, some of them, as something that would be our legacy, or that would be the epitome of progress. It would be the next step in evolution. That's how they view things. And what scares me about these people, Steve, is not necessarily that they could or couldn't pull this off. It's that whatever they do, they're approaching it from a godless framework. And that really is the problem. And I know time is short here. But if you look at the article...
Well, we're kind of about running out of time. So I think we probably, that's maybe a bit of a downer to end on, but it is perhaps appropriate. Bottom line, there are dangers associated with AI, as with all technology, the danger being primarily that it will be abused and misused by the wrong people, by people with this type, and the same has been true of every other type of technology. But I think we can agree that probably the Terminator-esque vision of the future may be exaggerated, and this may be a distraction keeping us from perceiving the real and present danger associated with AI. Thanks a lot, Selwyn. Really appreciate the discussion. As always, very stimulating. And we'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you, Steve, and God bless.
Sophia paused before the door. It read, Department of Bi-Digital Convergence. Just inside was a new world, a better world, the one of everlasting life, of no pain, of no loss, of no problem. She entered the chamber, and her surroundings changed. She saw around her an infinite field of waving golden grain surmounted by cloudless blue sky. The AI voice whispered gently in her mind, Welcome to the singularity. She couldn't see it and couldn't feel it, but her body had almost instantly been covered by a swarm of tiny gray multi-legged bots that melted through her clothes and into her skin. Not perceiving the nightmare, her eyes had already been consumed and the rest of her body was dissolving as the bots digested her flesh. She felt only a warmth suffusing her being. Drowsy, she drifted to sleep, and her last thought was one of panic. Would she ever wake? Could a nightmare vision like this be an outcome of the much-hyped transhumanist technological singularity? Enter the world of the future as illuminated by the experience of the past in Endgame, the new book by Dennis Barrett, the publisher of The New American Magazine, and find out how the disastrous COVID pandemic response fits with the technocratic elite's thirst to create a transhumanist utopia. Get Endgame from shopjbs.org with free shipping with code ENDSHIP, E-N-D-S-H-I-P. Or get Endgame and the Great Reset Collector's Issue of The New American Magazine and get free shipping plus an additional 20% off both with code END20, E-N-D-2-0.
And to complete today's show, two members of the John Birch Society's legislative and research team discuss how the ConCon locomotive has been thrown off track thanks to growing awareness of the dangers a modern-day constitutional convention pose. Let's watch.
This is Christian Gomez with the New American Magazine for today's legislative update. Peter Rakowski joins us now to discuss what's happening in the battle for legislation in the states and in the federal government. So, Peter, welcome back to the show.
It's great to be on, Christian. Thank you.
So, you know, we've talked about all sorts of legislation at the federal level and state level, and today let's talk about ConCon. What's happening with that? Now, with it being, you know, the virtually the beginning of summer or on the precipice of the beginning of summer, most states have adjourned. So what's happened this past year at ConCon?
Yeah, well, it's actually been a really good year in, you know, the fight to protect our Constitution. The ConCon resolutions have been considered in almost two dozen states, and in almost all of them, state legislators have rejected the various ConCon applications. So far, we have 20 states that have rejected ConCon applications, which include but are not limited to South Dakota, Virginia, Texas, Iowa, Wyoming, Montana, New Hampshire, and several other states as well. Wow. And in some of those states, the majority of the state legislators actually voted against some of the various resolutions. And in all the other states, the resolutions either died in committee or just weren't considered at all. The only exception was Oklahoma, which passed a term limits resolution. But that was very expected because the Oklahoma legislators, unfortunately, very pro-ConCon. And it's not the first application that they've passed. So Oklahoma is the exception, but it's only a minor exception. But overall, almost every state has voted against or otherwise rejected applications for a ConCon, so it's been a good year so far.
Wow, that's a good update. Quite succinct and straight to the point. Now, with regards to Oklahoma, you mentioned it was not their first ConCon application a few years back, if I recall, maybe more than just a few years ago, as time goes by quickly. The state of Oklahoma, their legislature passed a joint BBA and Convention of States resolution all in the same resolution that included both of those. So this one just tacks onto what the states are already done. So it's really not an increase in the overall movement of states pushing for a convention.
Right, that's right. Yeah, as you mentioned, they passed another resolution that included both the COS and BBA ones. And this one simply adds on to it.
Now, before you also just mentioned that of all those two dozen or so states that had ConCon applications that were introduced for Article 5 convention and that were all defeated or died in there, they didn't all die in committee. Sometimes these things, there just isn't traction for it, fortunately, and they die in committee. But in some of these cases, they made it past their committees. There was support in the committees enough to get them to a floor vote, but they died on the floor. And that's huge because usually when there's a vote on the floor of any state legislature or Congress, typically there's a sense that it could pass the legislature in order to avoid the embarrassment, not always, but typically to avoid the embarrassment of a defeated vote. And the states that you named, correct me if I'm wrong, those are mostly Republican-controlled dominated states, which is interesting because the Convention of States organization, one of the leading proponents for a constitutional convention, tell us that it's the left. It's Soros. It's Hillary Clinton. It's Common Cause. It's all these leftist groups that are trying to stop the efforts for a convention. Yet here are Republican states with Republican-dominated legislatures that aren't dominated by Hillary or Soros that killed many of these ConCon resolutions. What do you attribute to that victory on the conservative side for defeating the Article 5 convention applications?
Yeah, well, first off, as you mentioned, in Wyoming and Montana, Republicans have super majorities, so not just simple majorities, but almost the entire legislature are Republican. Then New Hampshire has slim Republican majorities, but nonetheless, Republicans have majorities in the legislature. And, you know, a huge reason for these victories is because of the work of the John Birch Society in those states. We have members and field coordinators in those states on the ground, in the state houses, educating and informing the various legislators about why a ConCon is so dangerous and why we need to avoid it and why we need to instead be rescinding existing applications and pursuing nullification as the proper strategy for limiting the federal government or restoring the limitations. So really, it's the work of the John Birch Society in educating these legislators, which is why these Republican states have voted against the various CONCON applications.
No, everything you said so far sounds great, but the work isn't over this year. There's still a few states left in play. Not as many as are not in play, but there's still a few lingering. So can you tell us what still remains in the CONCON battle this year, 2023?
Yeah, so there's still a few states. So one of them is Maine. There are two resolutions right now in the Maine legislature. HP 1058, which is a COS resolution, it follows the COS language, and then SP 705, which is actually a hybrid resolution with the Wolfpack resolution, which calls for a convention to propose an amendment to repeal the Supreme Court Citizen United decision. And if this convention would go the way that Wolfpack envisions it, it would severely restrict the First Amendment. So it's very dangerous, even on its face, a very dangerous proposal. But that resolution also includes term limits, which would ostensibly appeal to some of the Republicans in the Maine legislature.
Well, so that's huge, because Wolfpack is a left-wing organization, as you alluded to, pointed out, that was founded by Cenk Uygur, the host of the Young Turks, which is a far-left Marxist program on YouTube and even on some cable providers carry their channel. So Cenk Uygur, Lawrence Lessig are some of the folks behind Wolfpack. They're not conservative. They're not typically appealing to Republicans in anything that they state and believe in. And here they are tacking on term limits. Why do you think that is, that we're seeing this Wolfpack left and right working together for a CONCON resolution in Maine?
Well, I mean, Wolfpack is on the decline. There have been two states that have actually rescinded their resolution. And we saw in New Hampshire where Wolfpack actually tried to fly in activists to advocate for the COS, Convention of States Resolution, which is ostensibly a conservative application.
So people shouldn't be fooled by who the face of the organization is. Oh, you know, Michael Ferris, he's good on homeschooling, good conservative guy. Oh, you know, Mark Meckler, he's for, you know, protecting the U.S. border. You could look at these things and find something that maybe you like about them. But don't be fooled, because these same individuals, from what you're telling me, they're working with leftists like Cenk Uygur and Lawrence Lessig to get a constitutional convention. That is huge, and it makes you wonder what they really want out of a convention outside of the talking points on the front of their materials that they that the different groups hand to legislators.
Yeah, and we've seen on other issues as well, Democrats and Republicans, different parties ostensibly, but working together on many of these issues, whether it's foreign policy or spending, et cetera, and CONCON, you know, trying to change or even abolish the U.S. Constitution, replace it with, you know, a document with radical leftist provisions. You know, unfortunately, that's another issue where both parties are actually working towards.
So what's happening in some other states? We have Pennsylvania and North Carolina. What's happening in those two?
Well, in Pennsylvania, there are several different resolutions introduced, some for a convention of states, term limits. There's another resolution that would call for a convention to propose an amendment allowing two-thirds of states to override federal actions.
That sounds a lot like nullification.
Yeah, so it's completely unnecessary, and it would actually constitutionalize many of the federal government's unconstitutional laws and regulations.
So that one's called SR 52, Senate Resolution 52 of Pennsylvania, which calls for two-thirds of the states to be able to override federal action. So they want an amendment that would would enable two-thirds of the states collectively to overturn. So essentially, correct me if I'm wrong, this takes the concept of nullification, which allows for one state to stop unconstitutional federal action, and now increases the bar that will require you to have a lot more states before you can take that action, if that amendment were to hypothetically be proposed and ratified to the U.S. Constitution.
Exactly. So it would make it a lot harder to actually enforce the U.S. Constitution.
Is it Democrats who are supporting that resolution? Because that sounds very anti-conservative.
It's mostly Republicans who are supporting this.
Wow.
So it really shows the lack of education among, you know, even in the state legislators, people who are supposed to know a lot about, you know, our form of government and about the Constitution.
These PA Republicans need to get in contact with their counterparts in South Dakota and Wyoming and Iowa, and just to get a quick little schooling on the dangers of an Article 5 convention. So anyway, what else is going on? What about North Carolina?
Yeah, North Carolina, there are even more resolutions, again, for COS, for term limits. There's a faithful commissioner bill, which all it does is it gives legislators false assurance that a convention will do what they want it to do, rather than, you know, leading to a runaway convention where anything could happen, you know, including throwing out the existing constitution. And all three of these bills and resolutions have already passed the state house. They're pending in the state senate, but for the past several months, nothing has happened in the state senate. So they're stalled in the senate. But just because they're stalled doesn't mean that nothing will happen in the coming months. So people in North Carolina need to be very alert and contact their state senators and tell them, you know, oppose these resolutions, H.J.R. 235, H.A.R. 151 and H.B. 648.
And to make it easier for those of you that are watching, if you don't remember those bills, of course, pause and watch back. But also, go to JPS.org and click on the Act Now Legislative Alerts tab on states. Click on the map to the state that corresponds to you and see what's going on there and act upon these to stop these con-cons. If you don't live in one of these states, remain vigilant as well. We're really out of time, but I'll just throw in one more in there, Peter. What's happening in Texas? The session just ended, but there was a bill to extend the COS, which had a sunset clause. Can you tell us very briefly about that before we close?
Yeah, so in 2017, Texas passed a COS resolution, but it also passed a separate resolution that said that any resolution passed in the future, including that COS resolution, would automatically be rescinded in 8 years. The 8-year mark comes in 2025, so 2 years from now. But the COS advocates in Texas wanted to double that sunset period so the application would remain in effect for another 8 years. Thankfully, that resolution failed. It passed the Senate, but it failed in the House.
And many thanks to a lot of hardworking Birchers in Texas who
exactly made
that possible.
Right. Yeah, but there is the risk of the governor calling a special session, potentially, to actually pass this resolution to extend the sunset period.
Well, hopefully Governor Abbott won't pull a Governor Newsom in declaring or wanting a constitutional convention. Well, anyway, Peter, thank you so much for your time. And for those of you that are watching, again, jbs.org and click on those alerts. Take care and God bless.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of The New American TV. And remember to visit thenewamerican.com for more truth behind the news. We will see you tomorrow.
I certainly would not want a constitutional convention. I mean, whoa. Who knows what would come out of that?
It isn't the Constitution that's the problem. It is the people who ignore the Constitution.
What we need are just more people that would read the one we have.
It's up to us to hold our elected officials accountable.
Who understand the Constitution and are willing to take a stand when necessary.